From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Alt-right is short for alternative right, a fringe element that has effectively taken over the Republican Party.
That was Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in late July speaking about Donald Trump, the alternate right, and Vladimir Putin.
And this is part of a broader story, the rising tide of hardline right-wing nationalism around the world. And the grand godfather of this global brand of extreme nationalism is Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I think I would have a very, very good relationship with Putin, and I think I would have a very, very good relationship with Russia.
And that was Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump this past week at a commander-in-chief forum hosted by Matt Lauer of NBC News.
As I said, take a look today. Take a look at what happened with their fighter jets circling one of our aircraft in a very dangerous manner. Somebody said less than 10 feet away. This is hostility.
We're in a new and more dangerous Cold War with Russia.
That was Dr. Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian studies at NYU and Princeton, speaking on CNN last month.
We're approaching a Cuban missile crisis, nuclear confrontation with Russia, both along Russia's borders and possibly over Syria. There is absolutely no discussion, no debate about this in the American media. Then along comes, unexpectedly, Donald Trump, who says something that suggests he wants to end the new Cold War. And now, astonishingly, the media is full of what only can be called neo-McCarthyite charges that he's a Russian agent, that he's a Manchurian candidate, that he's Putin's client.
Taking a look at the new Cold War through the eyes of people in Russia, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, who's a print and radio journalist with the Russian news agency Sputnik, via Skype from Moscow Friday.
The situation is getting more and more dangerous between Russia and the United States because, the United States doesn't show any interest in a compromise. And even when they say they want a compromise, usually it's just a trick in order to get more concessions.
I'm wondering how we got here. After the end of the Cold War, and actually after the end of the Soviet Union, that was supposedly the big threat, the U.S. went to war almost immediately with Iraq in 1991. And with Russia's consent, or the Soviet Union's consent, Yeltsin's consent in essence, 12 years later, after Yugoslavia, after a bunch of adventures in Africa and elsewhere, Russia, China, and a number of other members of the Security Council said no. And Libya, some other instances where they weren't blocking the U.S. from doing some of its more offensive acts. But in Syria now, they're actually on opposite sides, and Russia has taken some casualties even with guns that probably came from the United States.
Well, I think that the United States changed a lot. Probably a lot more than Russia and the Soviet Union since the 80s. I would say that the changes were tremendous. I mean, Ronald Reagan, compared to the people we now have in the White House, looks like a pacifist, because he used some very heavy rhetoric, like Russia is the empire of evil, which was partially true about the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union, don't get me wrong, It had a lot of defects, to put it mildly. It never got rid of that terrible idea that there should be no private ownership of businesses. You can only own a car or maybe an apartment, but not a machine to produce other things. That was stupid, and that ultimately brought the Soviet Union down. But Ronald Reagan, despite this heavy rhetoric, he was very cautious not to provoke the Soviet Union or anyone else into a serious confrontation. Remember that he never got into the, what was called then the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union. He could support, he theoretically could support the rioters in Poland he could support the movements inside, you know, some other members of the Soviet Union, but he chose not to do it. And even with Afghanistan, he did it secretly. Okay, he attacked, you know, by his proxies. He tried to attack Nicaragua, but even Mr. Brezhnev acknowledged that Nicaragua is not Russia's domain. So Reagan, compared to Obama today, was a pacifist. I think that the main change came with the administration of Mr. Obama. Again, compared to him, George W. Bush was a pacifist. I would remind you that his father, George W. Herbert Bush, in 1991, when actually he had a chance to support the Ukrainian insurgent movement in 1991 in what was then still the Soviet Union, he chose not to do it. He was lambasted for that by the mainstream American media. You know, they even coined that stupid expression, chicken Kiev speech, you know.
Right.
Kiev speech was George Bush the senior speech in which he urged Ukrainians not to get into a conflict with Moscow. But that was a very wise approach that actually gave Russia and the United States and Europe 25 years of relative peace. Unfortunately, Obama chose to support the most reactionary, you know, the most, I would say, even medieval nationalist forces in Ukraine, which were masquerading as pro-European, civilized, nice people. And I think that the decision to support very actively the Maidan coup in Ukraine was, I think, the most fateful decision of Obama's administration. His stubborn support for the insurgency, you know, the armed insurgency in Syria, was also catastrophic. And ultimately, it led to the creation of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But I think that the decision with Ukraine was even more dangerous, because it didn't just destabilize the whole region. It didn't just kill the Ukrainian economy. It also brought us closer to a nuclear conflict. So I think 90% of the responsibility is with Obama and Mrs. Clinton and John Kerry, you know, who also was instrumental in that catastrophic decision, and of course his deputy Victoria Nuland. But in general, I agree with you that it's not just because of three or four bad people that we got there. You know, it was a wrong ideology which the US administrations had since the late 80s. You know, ideologically they misinterpreted the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. They misinterpreted it as their ultimate victory, which entitled them to become the new masters of the universe. That was a terrible mistake, and we're still living through the consequences of that mistake.
You know, there's been a slow process also in the backfield game, ongoing almost since 1991. There was a promise by Bush to Gorbachev that there would be no growing or moving closer of NATO to Russia. And there's been a steady movement, of course, as you know, since then, through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration and even the Obama administration, to the point where NATO has now thousands of troops on Russia's western border, in the northwest, all the way to the southwest almost. And they're talking about or announcing, really, a military partnership with Kiev. Where do you see this going?
Well, I mean, we still have to see a single case where the Obama administration or Mrs. Clinton, where they would acknowledge a mistake and where they would at least back off. You know, George W. Bush, in the end of his tenure, I remember how his rhetoric changed. He suddenly started speaking about acting collectively with other countries. He suddenly remembered about the role of the UN, which he declared obsolete in 2003, 2004. We still haven't seen it. I mean, the talks in Geneva, which Mr. Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and the head of the State Department, John Kerry, will be having, you probably noticed how the rhetoric of Kerry changes every day.
Right.
In the morning, we can hear from him that we never existed on Mr. Assad leaving his office. We always concentrated on fighting the ISIL. And then in the evening, we hear Assad must go. It just happens every day. So there was no real repentance in the United States and in the administration for what they called a mistake of invading Iraq in 2003. Not a single person was punished. Unfortunately, I don't see any signs of repentance for destabilization of Ukraine. The people who got the United States into this mess, they are all in power. They are all being promoted. We hear a whole, concert of lies about, making Ukraine progress along the road of European reform. We have all of these advisors from other countries coming and supposedly reforming the Ukrainian economy. What we don't hear is any reports about the economy of Ukraine getting better. We don't hear any reports about people being happy with the new police, which has the same uniforms as the American police. We don't hear anything about, less people getting killed because of crime, less people getting killed because of the continued civil war. So the happiness, the joy never comes. And here you have a big difference between what the United States is up to now and what the United States has been doing in 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, when indeed the United States allowed the countries like Japan, Germany, South Korea, when the United States allowed them to become rich. Let's face it, today these countries would not be allowed to become rich because, of course, they copied a lot of American car models. Of course, they used a lot of American technology, sometimes breaching the copyright, which was not yet so developed then. But the United States did not make a scandal out of it because they needed these countries as rich, successful states in order to deflect the sympathies of developing nations from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was an alternative. And now we have no alternative. The alternative is just slowly emerging in the form of China and Russia. And in this situation, the United States simply doesn't develop its own allies. It allows these allies to become poorer and poorer, like Ukraine or like countries of Eastern Europe. You know, the situation in Bulgaria or in Hungary is terrible. It's much worse than a few years ago.
The administration that came into power with the coup in Kiev is in fact a Nazi administration. They certainly are Nazi sympathizers. They invoke the memory of a Nazi sympathizer. They invoke Nazi customs and their ideological positions are very similar, with the substitution of Ukraine for Germany in the ideological language. At the same time that the United States installed this ultra-right-wing government in Ukraine, they are accusing President Putin of being the global leader of a global right-wing conspiracy. How do they maintain this narrative in front of the people outside the United States?
I would say that the rhetoric of the authorities in Kiev is a little bit more complicated than the rhetoric of the persons whom they deify and glorify, former Nazi sympathizers like Stepan Bandera and others, who helped the German Nazis to fight the Red Army and who later destroyed a big part of Polish population in Ukraine. I would say that right now the supremacist ideology or the new Ukrainian regime, it's more based on what they call values than on ethnic origin. You can be a Russian speaker, like the interior minister of the new Ukrainian regime, Arsen Avakov. He doesn't speak Ukrainian. He doesn't speak English. He admits that he only speaks Russian, and he is Armenian by blood. But he shares their narrative. He shares what they call their values. He thinks that it would be better if Ukraine had been occupied by Hitler rather than by Stalin. He admires all the things Western. He invites Western advisors. He is extremely hostile to Russia. He is extremely cruel to the population in the east of Ukraine, which he helped to bomb and to destroy by all methods. So he is theirs, despite the fact that he doesn't speak Ukrainian. And a lot of people in the West, and even some so-called liberals in Russia, they are misled by the fact that the new Ukrainian regime may not fit some of the modern stereotypes about the Nazis. For example, it doesn't openly persecute Jews, but you can be a Nazi and at the same time you can leave Jews in peace for some time. You know, Mussolini was not anti-Semitic until he became an ally of Hitler. Nazi ideology, this attitude of hatred towards certain groups, it may not be targeted against Jews. It can be targeted against Russians, as in the case of the current Ukrainian regime. It can be targeted against Gypsies. It can be targeted against Serbs, like the ideology of the nationalist regime that it's installed itself in Croatia in the early 90s. And people in the West have been misled by the movies, by some primitive newspaper articles. They have been misled into thinking that Nazi Germany was just about anti-Semitism. It was about persecuting the gay people. No, not necessarily. The Nazi Germany was just about destroying your enemy and declaring whole groups of population your enemies. The new Ukrainian regime is also about that. And that's why it sometimes manages to mislead even some people in Russia into believing that they are something better than they are.
There was a foreign policy forum held by NBC in the United States, hosted by Matt Lauer the other night, where he had first a sit-down with Hillary Clinton and then with Donald Trump. And in the process of that discussion, Lauer was questioning Trump's approach to Russia, to relations with Russia, that Trump had said it would be better to have good relations with Russia and cooperate in things like dealing with ISIS than to have a war with Russia. And in terms of setting up the question, he made a litany list, as Matt Lauer, of sins supposedly committed by Russia that included Russia invading Ukraine. He wasn't challenged on that by anyone, and I still haven't seen anyone in the media here challenge that. But what are the facts?
Well, I mean, people like Donald Trump or his advisor Michael Flynn, they are subjected to such pressure in the United States that I don't actually blame them for sometimes repeating the untruths which have become so widespread in the media. I mean, Michael Flynn was literally chased after, he was there was a real character assassination campaign against him in the Washington Post simply because he came to an event, to a conference organized by the RT, formerly Russia Today, last year in Moscow. They had his pictures at that conference published And there was such a campaign against him that I actually don't blame him when I think yesterday he said that Russia and China also, let me quote it, support certain criminal cyber groups, end of quote. Well, I mean, there are all kinds of people in Russia and China, and there can be some corrupt government officials, but Russia is not behind, the Russian state is not behind the hacking of the NGC's computers in the United States. I don't think Putin or anyone in Russia is particularly, is particularly fond of Mrs. Clinton, of course, but we don't get involved in this election because it's up to the American people to decide whom they want to govern them. But it is obvious that Clinton's campaign has decided to put all the blame on Russia instead of answering the question of substance. How come that NDC acted against Bernie Sanders? How come that Mrs. Clinton voted for the invasion of Iraq? How come she got the United States involved in the mess in Syria? Instead of asking all these questions, people are just reading the newspaper articles about allegedly, you know, Russia hacking Mrs. Clinton's computers. As for the questions from Matt Lauer, I'm not an expert on Hillary Clinton's emails, and I don't quite understand the substance of that scandal. I think there are many more scandalous things about Hillary Clinton than just her misusing the email. She, you know, just read John Pilger, you know, the famous Australian director who interviewed people in Afghanistan whose homes were destroyed by American bombs when Hillary was the Secretary of State. You know, read his articles. Read the articles in the New York Times, how Hillary became a hawk, what kind of person she is and what kind of relationship she has with militarists. Generals in the U.S. Army. That is the real cause for concern. I don't care how she sent her messages, via protected email or via unprotected email.
Finally, the starting up of what they're calling here the Cold War 2.0, pointing to Russia as the source of all evil, as the major threat to the United States, and the home of the master of a great right-wing conspiracy. You know, there was an ideological difference between the United States and the Soviet Union in the post-war period that was at the heart of the Cold War. Communist ideology, Marxist ideology that was the principal ideology of the USSR was seen as a threat to the United States, and that was the organizing principle that was used. Now, they're essentially calling Russia a fascist country. They're saying that Putin is behind all of these right-wing movements that are rising in various parts of the world, and that Trump represents that in the United States. If Hillary Clinton is elected, or whoever is elected, the environment, you know, the political discourse in the United States will have that at the foundation. Do people in Russia see that as a threatening condition?
Well, people are starting to get worried in Russia, because, and this is very bad news, because for many years, people in Russia had the same problems as all the normal people in normal countries. They were concerned about their soaring prices, they were concerned about inflation, they were concerned about unemployment. Now, according to a recent opinion poll conducted by FCIOM, you know, which is like the main opinion poll center in Russia, now people are more concerned by the possibility of a new war or a major international crisis. They are not even concerned by their soaring prices as much. And this is very bad development, because usually Russians feel protected. Even in the times of the Cold War, we felt protected by the strong army. And despite the military superiority of the United States, people around me, I remember my childhood, almost none of them seriously believed that the United States would attack us. And in general, the image of the United States was very positive, despite the Soviet media, which was officially negative about the United States. American movies were extremely popular. People on the street were friendly towards Americans. They are still friendly even now. And the image of the United States was, you know, that of a successful country. Now it's a different matter. And the situation is very dangerous, because whoever comes to power in the United States with Mrs. Clinton, we still don't know what kind of team she would bring with herself. It is quite clear that she intends to confront Russia. It's very interesting that for many years Bill Clinton was portrayed by the liberal Russian media as a Russia sympathizer, as someone very warmly, someone with a very warm attitude towards Russia. He said it many times himself. And now we have this terrible hostility from his wife. So it just shows you how shaky the policy lines of the United States are. And that creates difficulties, because Russia this time will require written guarantees from Washington on any agreement on arms reduction, from any agreement on non-aggression in any sphere. You know, under Yeltsin, very often Russia was quite happy with oral assurances and with general declarations of peace and friendship. Now, Russia will not be contented by anything except written guarantees. And written guarantees is something that the United States government almost never gives, even when much more peaceful presidents were in power, like Kennedy or even like Richard Nixon. It was very reluctantly that Nixon ultimately signed the arms reduction treaties with Brezhnev. And he faced enormous opposition when he did it. So I'm not particularly optimistic, but I hope that the public opinion in the West will finally wake up. I mean, look what's going on in the United States. If you look at the history of American presidential campaigns, you never had anything like that. You know, the president openly blasts one of the candidates during the election. He also openly and quite actively endorses the other candidate. That never happened. Okay, president endorsed the candidates from their own party, like, I don't know, George W. Bush endorsed McCain, or Reagan endorsed George Bush the senior, but they never did it so rudely and openly and with a lot of negative rhetoric about the other candidate. That destroys the foundation of democracy, because the foundation of democracy is neutrality of the state during elections. So what's going on right now in the United States should worry Americans probably even more than Russians, because it's a classical situation when aggressive foreign policy ultimately destroys democracy inside the aggressor country. And even the experience of the Roman Republic, which became Roman Empire, tells us that when the empire gets too big and when it gets too aggressive, democracy simply can't survive. You will have most likely a militaristic ruler and a huge bureaucratic regime to support that militaristic ruler. Suddenly, the Senate, the democratic institutions, the courts become a mere decoration, like they were a mere decoration under the so-called emperors or principals, as they were called. So I think that this is a very instructive but tragic experience that we're going through now.
Dmitry Babich, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.